Chapter 2. The high street is under a wet, silvery evening mist. The street lamps have big yellow courtyards of light about them, and the people are walking on cotton wool. Shop windows show up to right and left like mysterious fires. Wolf swims up through the fog and dives into it again. The trees gleam black and wet under the street lamps. With me is Valentin Laher. He is not complaining, exactly, but he cannot forget the famous acrobatic turn with which he made such a hit in Paris and Budapest. "That's all finished now, Ernst," he says. "My joints creak like a stiff shirt, and I've got rheumatism, too. I've rehearsed and rehearsed till I've dropped. It's no use trying it anymore."
"What will you do then, Valentin?" I ask.
"The state should give you a pension, really, the same as it does retired officers."
"Ah, the state," answers Valentin contemptuously. "The state only gives those anything that open their mouths wide enough. I'm working up a couple of turns with a dancer just now, a bit of a leg show, you know. It promises well enough as regards a public, but it's not much. A decent artist ought to be ashamed of doing such a thing, really. But then, what's a man to do? He must live."
Valentin is going now for a rehearsal, so I decide to accompany him. At the corner of Hampken Street, a black bowler hat goes trundling past us in the fog, and beneath it, a canary-yellow Macintosh and a portfolio.
"Arthur!" I shout.
Lederhose stops.
"My hat!" exclaims Valentin. "But you have got yourself up swell."
With the air of a connoisseur, he fingers Arthur's tie, a handsome affair in artificial silk with lilac spots.
"Oh, yes, not so bad, not so bad," says Lederhose,
flattered and in haste.
"And the lovely Sunday go-to-meeting lid, too," says Valentin,
with renewed astonishment, examining the bowler. Lederhose is in a hurry. He taps his portfolio.
"Business, business."
"Don't you run the cigar shop anymore?" I ask.
"Sure," he replies. "But one extends gradually. You don't happen to know of any offices to let, I suppose. I pay any price."
"Offices? Can't say we do," says Valentin.
"We haven't got so far yet. But how does the missus suit you these days?"
"How do you mean?" asks Lederhose cautiously.
"Well, you used to moan enough about it out there. She was grown too scraggy for you, so you said, and you were all out for fat ones."
Arthur shakes his head.
"I don't remember to have said that."
And he vanishes. Valentin laughs.
"How they do change, eh, Ernst? What a miserable poor worm he was up the line. Now look, what a swell businessman. Remember how the blighter used to pig it out there? But he won't hear of it anymore. He'll be president of some league or other for the promotion of pure morals yet, you see."
"Things do seem to be going bloody well with him, though," I say meditatively. We stroll on. The fog drifts, and Wolf plays with it. Faces come and go. Suddenly, in the white clear light, I see a glistening red patent leather hat, and beneath it, a face softly bloomed with the dampness that makes the eyes shine the more brightly. I stand still. My heart is beating fast.
That was Adela.
Swiftly, memories spring up of other evenings when we 16-year-olds would hide outside the doors of the gymnasium, waiting till the girls should come out in their white sweaters. And then we would run after them down the streets and overtake them, only to stand before them, breathing hard, silent, staring at them, till they would break away and the chase start all over again.
and the afternoons when, if we happened to meet them somewhere, we would walk shyly and stolidly after them, always a few paces behind them, much too embarrassed to speak to them. And only as they turned in at some house would we suddenly summon up all our courage and shout after them, "See you again!" and run away. Valentin looks around. "I have to go back for a moment," I say hastily. "I want to speak to someone. I'll be here again in a minute." And I run off in search of the red hat, the red glow in the mist, the bright days of my youth before uniforms and trenches. "Adela!" She looks around. "Ernst! You back again!" We walk side by side. The mist flows between us. Wolf jumps up about us and barks. The trams are ringing, and the world is warm and soft. The old feeling is there once again, full, tremulous, wavering. The years are blotted out. An arch has flung over into the past, a rainbow, a bright bridge through the mist. I have no idea what we are talking about. What does it matter? The point is that we are walking side by side, that this sweet, inaudible music of other days is here again, a cascade of dreams and desire, beyond which shimmers silken the green of meadows, beyond which sings the silver chatter of the poplar trees, and the smooth horizon of youth shows clear like the dawn. Have we been walking long? I do not know. I run back alone. Adela has said goodbye. But still, like a big, many-colored banner, there waves within me joy and hope and fullness. The little room where I was once a boy, summer, the green spires and the open, wide world. As I run back, I bump into Vili and we go on together in search of Valentin. We overtake him. With every appearance of joy, he darts off after some fellow whom he gives a resounding slap on the back.
"Hello, Kukov, old son. Where have you sprung from?"
He holds out his hand.
"This is a bit of luck, eh? Fancy meeting again like this."
The other looks at him a while, deprecatingly.
"Ah, Laher, I think?" "Sure, man. Why, we were together on the Somme, don't you remember? And how, right in the middle of the bloody stunt, we polished off those fritters Lily sent me? It was Georg brought them up with the mail. A damned risky thing to do, you know, what?"
"Yes, indeed," says the other. Valentin is quite excited by his memories.
"He got it properly later on, though," he continues. "You'd gone then, of course. Lost his right arm, he did. Stiff luck on a coachman like him. I suppose he's had to start something else now. But where have you been hiding all this time, eh?"
The other makes an evasive answer, then says patronizingly, "Nice to have met you. And how are you getting along now, my man?"
"Eh?"
retorts Valentin in astonishment.
"How are you getting along? What are you doing now?"
Valentin has still not recovered.
"My man?"
For a moment he continues to stare at the other as he stands there before him in his elegant raincoat. Then he glances down at his own things, goes fiery red, and pushes off.
"Skunk!"
I feel sorry for Valentin. It is the first time, apparently, that the idea of a difference has struck him. Until now, in his mind, we had all been just plain soldiers. And with one single, "my man," this conceited puppy has shattered his simple faith.
"Don't let that worry you, Valentin," I say. "It's the likes of him that pride themselves on how much their fathers earn. That's their business."
And Vili supplements with a few forceful expressions.
"Fine sort of pal he is, anyway,"
says Valentin at last, sullenly. But that does not take the taste away. it works on chokingly within him. Fortunately, at that moment, we run into Tjaden. He is as gray as a floor cloth.
"Say," says Vili, "the war is over now, you know. Couldn't you give yourself a good wash once in a while?"
"Not just now," explains Tjaden solemnly. "But next Saturday I will. I'm even going to have a bath then, and get de-loused too, what's more."
We start in surprise. Tjaden have a bath? Whatever's the matter with the man? He must have stopped something, surely, that time he was buried last August.
Vili, who is quite floored, puts a hand to his ear.
"I'm afraid I haven't understood you properly. What did you say you're going to do on Saturday?"
"Have a bath," says Tjaden proudly. "I'm getting engaged next Saturday night."
Vili stares at him as if he were some strange kind of parrot. Then, gently, he puts his great paw on Tjaden's shoulder and says in a fatherly tone,
"Say, Tjaden, do you sometimes have a stabbing pain in the back of the head? Or a funny buzzing sort of noise in your ears?"
"Only when I'm half-starved," Tjaden reassures him. "And then I have a regular bombardment in my belly, too. An awful feeling, that is, I tell you. But to come back to my fiancée, she isn't beautiful, mind you. She has two left legs, and she squints a bit, but she makes up for it with a heart. And then, you see, her father's a butcher."
A butcher? The light begins to dawn. Tjaden volunteers yet more information.
"You'd be surprised. She's so crazy about me. And, well, it's catch as catch can these days. Times are bad, you know, so a man has to make some sacrifices. But a butcher will be the last man to starve. And anyway, besides, engaged is after all still a long way from married."
Vili listens with growing interest.
"Tjaden," he begins, "you know we have always been good friends."
"Certainly, Vili," interrupts Tjaden.
"You may have a few sausages, and chops, too, to go with them for mine. Come around next Monday. We're having a white sale on Monday."
"White sale? What do you mean?" I ask, mystified. "Have you a drapery business as well?"
"No, not that. But you see, we are killing a white horse."
We promise faithfully to be there and go on our way. Valentin turns in at the Altstädterhof, where the artists put up. A group of Lilliputians are already sitting at supper as we enter. There is turnip soup on the table, and beside each is a piece of bread.
"Let's hope they at least can get a square meal off their ration cards," growls Vili. "They'll have smaller bellies, I suppose, don't you think?"
Pasted on the walls, there are playbills and photographs, varicolored patches, some of them half torn, and pictures of weightlifters and female lion tamers and clowns. They are old and faded. The front line has been the arena for weightlifters, crack riders, and acrobats during the past few years, and there they had no need of placards. Valentin points to one of them.
"That was me once."
In the picture is a fellow with a powder's chest, turning a somersault from a horizontal bar, away up the dome of a circus. But with the best will in the world, one could not recognize Valentin in it anymore. The dancer with whom he proposes to work is already waiting. We pass on into the little hall at the back of the restaurant. Some stage scenery is leaning in a corner. It belongs to the farce, Fly, Little Pineapple, a humorous piece from the lives of our lads in Field Gray, with songs for all, which had a great run for over 2 years. Valentin sets a gramophone on a chair and looks out some records. A hoarse melody issues croaking from the horn. The thing has been played to death, but one may still detect in it a vestige of wildness, like the used-up voice of a disconsolate woman who once was beautiful.
Tango,
Billy whispers to me, with the air of an adept that does not betray the fact that he has just read the inscription on the record. Valentine is wearing blue pants and a shirt. The woman is in tights. They practice an impasse dance and a fancy number where the girl finally hangs by the legs about Valentine's neck while he gyrates as fast as he can. The two rehearse in silence with grim faces. Only occasionally is a half-audible word spoken. The dim light of the lamp flickers. The gas hisses softly. The shadows of the dancers move immense across the scenery for the pineapple. Villy ambles back and forth like a bear to wind up the gramophone. Valentine finishes. Villy claps his applause. Valentine, ill-satisfied, makes a gesture to desist. The girl changes without even noticing us. Deliberately, she unbinds her dancing shoes beneath the gaslight. The back arches lithely under the faded tights. She straightens up and raises her arms to draw over some garment. Lights and shadows play on her shoulders. She has beautiful, long legs. Villy goes nosing around the room. He discovers a program for the pineapple. On the back are some advertisements. A confectioner, for instance, recommends bombs and shells made of chocolate, already packed to send off to the trenches. And a Saxon firm is offering letter openers made from shell splinters and closet paper with sayings of great men about the war. Also, two sets of picture postcards, The Soldier's Farewell and I Stand in the Darkest Midnight. The dancer has dressed. In cloak and hat, she looks quite strange. Before, she was a lithe animal. Now she is like all the others again. One would hardly believe that it is necessary only to put on a few bits of clothing to make such a difference. Most strange it is how clothes do change people, and uniforms more than all.